On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. New York City, the Big Apple, is going green. In a green vision extravaganza on Earth Day in New York, Mayor Michael Bloomberg laid out a blindingly ambitious 25-year plan to turn New York into America's urban green giant by 2030. 1 million new trees, green rooftops, new tolls on cars coming into the city, energy taxes, new mollusk beds to clean the rivers around Manhattan. If not now, when? Asked the mayor. Up next on Point, the Big Apple goes green and the global push for green cities. First, joining me now from New York City is Thomas Leek, who covered Mayor Bloomberg's Earth Day speech for the New York Times. Tom Leek, thanks very much for being here.
Hi, Tom.
So give us the scale of this thing. Give us a sense of what Mayor Bloomberg is proposing for your city, New York.
Well, it's huge. It's been, the mayor himself likened it to some of the great capital projects that the city has had over the last 100 years. Construction of Rockefeller Center, which is which was built during the Great Depression, the Central Park. It's very major, and it reflects a commitment over a long period of time to spend a very, very massive amount of money.
Give us a sense of what some of the major, it's 127 pieces to this vision. Who knows how much of it will actually be implemented. But what are the major pieces when it comes to making New York green? What kind of steps is Bloomberg proposing?
Well, the most controversial is the notion of congestion pricing, meaning that people that drive their cars into Manhattan, the most congested area of Manhattan, would have to pay a fee.
London does this already, but in New York's case, it would be from 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. south of 86th Street or something like that.
That's right, and only on weekdays, there are a number of exemptions. But still, it would be a substantial fee for drivers.
How much of the car traffic in Manhattan do people think that might cut out?
Hard to tell. Manhattan, for as long as anybody can remember, has been a very expensive place, difficult place to bring a car. It would have a major impact on suburban commuters, and it would also have an impact on tourists. And among city residents, I think the great concern is on working people, tradespeople, those who have to drive to fix your boiler, your elevator, that
right.
sort of thing. They can't take public transit, and that's an added fee on them.
But the goal of fewer cars in the city and fewer emissions right there, a big emphasis here on getting even more New Yorkers to live around public transportation.
That's correct. The city has been doing quite well over the last 10 or 20 years by many measures, including the fact that a lot of neighborhoods outside of Manhattan that were once in decline have been attracting more people. So now, given the fact that the city has a very large subway system, public transit network in place, they want to try and attract people, growth, development to those areas where people can walk to public transit.
A 30% cut in CO2 emissions by 2030. That's big, and that's not just for the city government, that's for the whole city?
Yes, indeed. I don't know how they came up with that number or exactly how they would expect to achieve it. But the important thing is that they are also estimating that the city will grow by 1 million people over that period of time. So you've got the combination of more people and more development and reduced greenhouse gas emissions. So it's a very ambitious goal.
1 million new trees, I read here, new mollusks
yep.
in the rivers
yep.
around the city
yep.
to try and filter out the pollution there. Did Mayor Bloomberg describe what New York would look like if all this comes to pass?
He did not. But I think it's fair to speculate that if this plan is achieved or anything like it, anything comes close to that, it would continue a trend that has been in place. A lot of the city in and out of Manhattan has become cleaner, has become greener. People have already been planting trees, sprucing up old neighborhoods. I think what the mayor has in mind is just to put in place an infrastructure, a plan that would support more of the same kind of growth.
And his warning, if New York doesn't do it, it just won't be sustainable.
Right. The notion is that you reach a point where there are just too many people in a confined space, too many cars, and you just reach a tipping point, and it doesn't work.
Thomas Leek, what are the odds that the state government in Albany, that Washington and the facets where it would be involved, are going to swing in behind New York City here and make this possible?
Well, that's a tough one, particularly the state government, I think. A lot of this would require state commitment of money and also the support of legislators who represent, for example, those suburban commuters who are feeling they're going to have to pay a fee and they're not going to see any of the benefit of this.
But a big, big, ambitious plan from Mayor Michael Bloomberg. We're going to look at the details of it and what the implications may be for the rest of the country, the rest of the world. Thomas Leek at the New York Times, thanks very much for joining us today. There was plenty of applause for Michael Bloomberg, some from California on the other side of the country. Here's California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger introducing the mayor via video conference link before the big Earth Day speech.
The mayor is my soulmate because we both believe in protecting the environment. He is a true environmental warrior who has been a leader in this issue for a long time. With your announcement today, New York leaps to the forefront of cities dedicated to attacking climate change and protecting our environment.
And let's listen to a little more of Mayor Bloomberg himself saying here that if his big sweeping proposals are enacted, they will sustain the city for future generations.
Let's face up to the fact that our population growth is putting our city on a collision course with the environment, which itself is growing more unstable and uncertain. Let's recognize that many of the gains we have made in the quality of our air, water, and land will be lost if we don't act. And let's remember tonight, when we put our children to bed, that they are the ones who will pay the heavy costs of our inaction. We can't let that happen.
Can't let that happen, says the mayor of New York City. Joining me now in the studio is Ashok Gupta, Program Director of Air for Air and Energy for the Natural Resources Defense Council. He's a member of Mayor Bloomberg's Sustainability Advisory Board, which came up with the plan to take New York green. Ashok Gupta, thanks very much for being here.
Hi, happy to be here.
So you're an environment guy on the NRDC. This is your life. What do you make of what the mayor is proposing here? Is this a big deal? Is it radical?
It's fantastic. It's amazing. It took a lot of work, a lot of analysis from the bottom up over a year. So a lot of details behind the plan, even more than what people see up front. I've lived in New York City for almost 30 years now, and I have seen the improvement even over that 30 years from the 70s and 80s. And the
sure, anybody who's visited has, and yet a million more people coming in and all the emissions that could come with that.
Exactly. I think the first thing people should remember is the cities like New York are already one of the best places to be if you're worried about emissions and because of efficiency and the fact that we have the best transit system in the world
already. You're close to your workplace. You jump on a subway. It's not automobile-based.
Exactly. So the fact that less than 5% of the people actually drive into work into Manhattan, and I think things like that are unusual in terms of the other parts of the country. So if you look at how we use energy, how we travel, how we use water, we're quite amazing and different than every other part of the world, even.
And yet, if you look at the impact of cities, and more and more of us in this world live in cities, I mean, just think of the consumption that goes on there, the requirements in water and clean air, the toxic pollution that's come out of cities over the years, the waste that goes out of cities. They're a huge challenge to the environment at the same time. I wish you'd try and paint a picture for us. Take us forward to 2030. If this big sweeping plan is implemented, how would New York look, feel, be structured differently than today?
I mean, you start with the buildings. The buildings will have to be designed differently, built in a way that they use a lot less energy than they even do now. They use a lot less water. They reuse and recycle water in their buildings. So it's really about mostly buildings, because that's where, 70-80% of our emissions are coming from directly or indirectly. We basically, even the electricity we use, the emissions may be somewhere else, but it's our consumption of energy in our buildings that's the key. And the plan looks at how to improve the design and operations of buildings, not just new buildings, but existing buildings, because that's where most of the pollution comes from.
Does this mean new zoning coming in, saying you've got to use more solar, light, energy, different reuse of water and all that? Do you impose this on real estate owners?
It's going to be a combination of incentives and requirements and allowing for some time so people know that regulation will be coming in 3 to 5 years. So the idea is to start by saying, this is going to happen. we want to work with you. We will provide incentives in the meantime, but get with the program because we have to do this if we're going to grow by 1 million people and make the city livable, have more parks, have all the things we need. So it's about energy use in building. It's about parks, and it's about giving people more options in terms of how they move around. In order to reduce congestion, we want to give people more options. And the key thing to focus on here is how to invest more in our transit is what the mayor wanted to do and had to come up with a financing strategy to invest more in transit.
Better buildings, better transit, a lot more green, 1 million more trees. And is this a kind of a rooftop green thing? Is the Manhattan skyline going to have, I don't know, oak trees on top of skyscrapers?
There's definitely a green roof piece to this plan, as well as a solar piece to the plan. But some of the technologies and strategies will be pretty invisible. Just better operation and maintenance is not, you know, something you can see but can save you 10-15% on your energy. So there are a lot of pieces here. There will be the visible pieces, and there will be the hidden invisible pieces that are quite cost-effective.
There's been a lot of apocalyptic thinking about cities and global warming. 2004, the movie The Day After Tomorrow, characters cling to life in Manhattan through a series of weather events, apocalypse, tsunami, rocking Manhattan. The cause? Global warming. In this trailer for the movie, we get an over-the-top prediction of New York's potential environmental future.
Lower Manhattan is virtually inaccessible.
A wall of water coming towards New York City. Everybody, get
down! There's the apocalyptic view of future New York. And, of course, it's not all up to New York, but Mayor Michael Bloomberg, speaking Sunday, Earth Day, at the American Museum of Natural History, says it's time to step up, that the city leaders have waited long enough for a comprehensive environmental policy.
As we look ahead at all the challenges we face in the coming decades, I'd like to suggest something rather unorthodox for government, something unusual. I'd like to suggest that we face up to those challenges not tomorrow, not in the future, not when it's too late, but right now.
Okay, maybe he's running for president too, I don't know, but he's talking about New York and its green future right now. I'm joined in the studio this hour by Ashok Gupta. He's Program Director for Air and Energy at the Natural Resources Defense Council and a member of the Sustainability Advisory Board to the Mayor of New York. They came up with this big sweeping plan. We're also joined from New York right now by Stephen Cohen, Executive Director of the Earth Institute at Columbia University. Part of its mission looks at urban growth and its impact on the environment. Stephen Cohen, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Lots of ballyhoo about this big new proposal in New York. You're an environmental guy down to your toes. How do you look at it? Is this a big deal? Is it overblown?
I think it's very important. I think it actually returns the city to its traditions of looking ahead. When we built the subway system, the water system, and literally the whole city, people looked 100 years ahead and said, what kind of city do we want to have? I'm sitting at Columbia University, which was built in the middle of the country about 100 years ago, and now we're in
what was the countryside? Yeah,
absolutely.
The world, I believe I read not long ago that the majority of the planet's population now lives in cities. I mean, can we address environmental problems, global warming, without somehow turning cities green?
Yeah, it's absolutely essential, and the city does provide us with some advantages because you have people concentrated; they're not spread all over the countryside. And you can have the kinds of energy efficiency that you heard about before. I think that we have to really build, though, infrastructure for the 21st century and for the 22nd century that uses information technology and does a better job than we have in the past of really being smart about how we grow.
How visible or invisible would these changes be? I mean, some of them we're reading about are partly to accommodate growth. They want to deck over huge rail yards and highways, concentrate people, apartments, and living around public transit. But if our listeners are trying to envision a really green city in 2030, will it look and feel different from a city today, Steve?
Oh, absolutely. And I think this city today looks very different than the city of 100 years ago. If you read accounts of New York City in the 19th century, you had to, walking across the street, you had to worry about horse manure everywhere. So I think that we're talking about a greener city. We're talking about a city that can attract people from all over the world. I mean, one of the things that's true about cities in the 21st century is that industry and people are highly mobile. People can move from place to place. And so we're in a competition, in a global competition for business with London and Hong Kong mm-hmm. and Paris and Singapore and a whole variety of places. And in order for us to compete, we have to provide the highest quality of life. So the air has to be clean, the water has to be clean, it has to be a great place to live, because otherwise people with means will just go to that next best place.
People have options. New York chooses to go green to try and keep them. Stephen Cohen at Columbia University's Earth Institute, thanks very much for being with us. Let me take a call from Boston. Steve is on the air. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me this morning.
Great to have you. What do you know?
Well, I would like to urge the city of New York and the mayor to invite, to include the community of faith in its plans and deliberations for the future. The community of faith has always been there, leading the way on the major justice issues of our times. We have marched through dogs and fire hoses and taken the occasional bullet for justice, and this is a major justice issue.
So you're talking about getting the country or the city's religious community involved. I don't know what role they may have played already, but why does that matter to you, Steve?
Well, we need to set an example. We need to be involved. And when, as for example, here in Boston, the mm-hmm. city of Cambridge, the city of Boston, and the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, the community of faith has been invited to participate. When we are practicing what we preach, which means energy conservation, energy efficiency, save energy, save money, create jobs at the same time, we can be models of what it means to take an old pile of stones or what have you and turn it into an environmental showcase.
So bring faith to the green table and get it behind the movement as a motivator. Of course, Boston has announced some of its own steps recently, as has Cambridge. Let me put it to you, Ashok Gupta, who have been the big drivers in the mayor's move? Is this just Michael Bloomberg sitting there, rich guy, big vision, you know, why not? Or has the New York's community of faith or the business community pulled in behind this? Who's really been pushing?
It's definitely come from the bottom up, and it's going to require everybody pitching in to make it happen. So community groups, environmental justice group, labor, business are all part of this. And if they weren't, it wouldn't be happening because it's too big a lift. And even having the mayor come out in this way doesn't happen easily. So there was a lot of consensus building, a lot of people involved in the advisory board and outside the advisory board. And what you're seeing now is also a launching of a campaign to actually move this initiative forward, because we're not going to just sit now that the plan is put mm-hmm. together. We have to sell it in Albany and elsewhere. So the campaign is getting bigger. More people are joining the effort.
Are there tensions between these different sectors? Does the business community take prodding from, you know, rabbis and preachers to get going, or are they gung-ho themselves for the reasons Stephen Cohen outlined? They're competing. They need New York to be attractive.
Believe it or not, the business community has been out front and leading. They want the city to be competitive. They want the city to deal with these problems, deal with infrastructure. We have an aging infrastructure. We have old power plants, an old delivery system for our water. We need to invest in the city. We need to improve all of the services in the city, and the business is out front. Labor is there. Community groups are there. And I think what we're trying to make sure is, you know, how you make the transition and not leave anybody behind, because there are, you know, short-term perception of winners and losers.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the challenge is to kind of have this, have everybody under the tent, have everybody pulling together. And I'm pretty excited about how much the city is coming together around this plan. And that's what it's going to take to actually move it forward. If everybody isn't pulling together, it ain't going to happen.
We hear that and the excitement, and it's terrific. Let's go to Georgetown, South Carolina, and Ken. Hi, Ken. You're on the air.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah.
Just want to let you know, I grew up in New Jersey, so I have some appreciation for the what you face in New York City.
Great.
I'm a forester down here, and I was curious as to why your guest sort of evaded the tree question. And my point is, you know, if you're going to plant a million trees out there, when we plant trees commercially, we're putting about 600 trees per acre out there. So you're talking about, you know, 1,500 to 2,000 acres of trees in a what would even look like a forest.
Right.
And if you drive by a forest, you can see it has some sort of function, whereas a million trees scattered on rooftops or over a broad area, is there really any function to them?
Oh, and is there just plain room for them? If you're calculating 1,500 to 2,000 acres, Ashok Gupta, how about it? 1 million trees by the year 2017, well before 2030, I'm reading in the plan here. And our forester friend Ken says, where are you going to put all those in an urban area like New York?
Yeah, I don't know if I have all the right numbers down, but when this plan in its earlier phase was taken to the communities, community groups, and feedback was received, the issue of trees and parks and green roofs came up all the time.
Mm-hmm.
I think for the public, it's about quality of life and having not just asphalt and cement around them, but seeing, you know, trees, seeing grass, having. So the idea is to figure out wherever we can, you know, look for opportunities on, you know, at,
so
on
it's,
side,
it's the visible piece. It kind of gets the public buy-in.
Yeah.
But what about Ken's?
On,
I mean,
on
he
side,
has two,
on
do you have room for that? And is there a real function? Is this just to look nice, or does it really help clean up an environment in a city like
it
New York?
It does both. And I think its value is in a quality of life in terms of what people want and why they'll want to live in the city and move to the city. And it's also about absorbing the CO2. But there's no one thing that you're trying to do here. You're trying to make the city an attractive place to live in while addressing all of the environmental issues. You're also trying to deal with stormwater runoff, the benefits.
Right, what's going to suck it up.
Yeah, and things like that. So we're looking at it broadly in terms of all of the benefits that this provides. It's not easy. It's challenging.
Right. But Forrester, Ken
city.
Wonders if you're going to have an impenetrable forest in Manhattan. Ken, thanks for that call. Let me go right now to Charlottesville, Virginia, and Timothy Beatley. He's professor of sustainable communities at the University of Virginia School of Architecture, author of Green Urbanism, Learning from European Cities. He's been spending a lot of time looking at cities around the world who are taking similar measures. Professor Beatley, thanks a lot for being with us.
Oh, nice to be with you. Hi, Tom.
Wonderful to have you. First, give us a sense. What company is, are New York and, I guess, what, Chicago, Boston, L.A., others are moving in here globally? Are cities stepping up to the environmental challenge?
Well, they are. There is a growing recognition that cities really have to be part of the solution to our global problems, our environmental challenges. And so there's been a green cities movement really globally and in North America, in this country, that's picking up steam. And so you see cities like Los Angeles and Chicago. You mentioned Chicago. Just a few years ago, Mayor Daley there announced that Chicago was going to be the greenest city in the country and did some very dramatic things, including retrofitting City Hall with a green rooftop. Los Angeles has announced also planting 1 million trees in that city. So New York is not alone. But the range of things and the comprehensive nature of the plan that Mayor Bloomberg has put forward is really quite impressive compared to many of those other places.
Let me ask you, with the degree of consumption that of necessity goes on in a city, you've just got so many people there, can they really be, you know, green spots, gills for the planet, or will they always be tough challenges to the environment? You know, can they be a net positive somehow or not?
Yeah. I think they can. I think there has historically been this sense that cities are antithetical to nature, that you have to leave the city to find any nature, to find a green spot. But I'm optimistic. I agree that there are lots of creative places to plant trees and that they serve many good functions. And we know we have a lot of unused rooftop space that could be green rooftops, and we could be growing food on them and doing all kinds of very creative stormwater management, green walls. We have lots of quivers in our green urbanism arsenal that maybe we didn't have just a decade or so ago.
Wow, that's an impressive picture. Let me take a call from Washington, D.C. Tara, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I am a landscape architect in Washington, D.C., and I hear a lot about buildings and architecture. I want to know, how does landscape architecture fit into this, because this is so central to our profession, best management practices, and sustainable open space development.
Tara, when you we civilians here, when you say landscape architecture in a city, what does that mean? Parks or more than parks?
It means parks, green roofs. In Washington, D.C., we do a lot of green roof development. We're working with LEED professionals, and that's one way that buildings become more sustainable. But, you know, sustainable development, stormwater management can be more than just piping your water underground like a lot of engineers will. It can be done in a beautiful way that's an amenity and attracts many good environmental you know, characteristics and incentives as well.
Let me put it to our guests, Timothy Beatley, Ashok, who can speak to landscape architecture here?
Well, I would just concur with what you just said, that the landscape architects have a tremendous opportunity to make a difference. And we have a whole different view, I think, about things like infrastructure today. So it isn't just about sending that water, that storm water away, putting it in a pipe, making it invisible, seeing it as a problem to be dealt with rather than an opportunity. So landscape architects today, marvelous stories and marvelous projects around the country and around the world of bringing that water back, daylighting streams, designing low-impact development.
Daylighting streams, meaning resurfacing streams that were paved over years ago?
That's exactly right. There's a trend in that direction, very, very exciting idea. It's not easy to do, to be sure, but the idea of actually restoring that natural hydrology that existed everywhere there's a city, and then bringing life back to the neighborhoods and connecting us back to that, to those natural systems, that can really, really be inspirational.
Do you picture, Timothy Beatley, cities globally looking fundamentally different a century from now if we respond to the environmental challenge to the extent that it's going to take? Are they going to look pretty much the same with a little more green poking out here and there?
Well, I'm hopeful that they'll look a lot different. I mean, cities are already very sustainable places to live. But if we really make a concerted effort to green them, I think they could. Green walls and trees.
What does that mean, green walls?
What's a green wall? Well, this idea of actually, it's almost a kind of vertical green wall idea. And we have a number of examples of buildings that have plants essentially growing on the facades of buildings and retaining stormwater and sequestering carbon and providing habitat in the same ways that a green rooftop does, in fact. But I think we're going to be moving to a different way of thinking about cities, so that cities, we begin to more carefully understand the inputs and outputs of those cities. And so, for example, energy. My future of cities are cities that are producing as much energy as they need locally and embedded in the built environment. So photovoltaics, solar hot water heating, even wind turbines, those sort of things. It's a different way of thinking about a city. Mm. It's not just drawing down resources. It's actually being restorative.
And self-sustaining in some dimension.
And self-sustaining to a considerable degree.
Ashok Gupta, what about the lifestyle of, in this case, New Yorkers? Will they have to change their way of living to help the city reach these ambitious goals?
The assumption in the 30% reduction, and that's a 30% from current levels.
CO2 emissions. By 2030.
Which is like 50% below business as usual.
Right.
We believe that can be actually done with existing technologies and without even changing one's lifestyle. There's so much waste in the system, even in an efficient city like New York, that by basically using the currently available technologies, better light bulbs, appliances, windows, in both new and existing buildings, we believe that this 30% is quite doable.
Right now, Robbie's calling from Burlington, Vermont. Robbie, you're on the air.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Sure.
I had a question. You've discussed a little bit about, the city producing its own, more of its own energy, kind of a distributed energy system. And up here in Vermont, we have a great deal of difficulty with something called NIMBYism, so not in my backyard. And I'm wondering if anything in the plan is included regarding zoning and in terms of developing these systems so that to basically encourage development of renewable energy systems within the city.
Robbie, let me just ask you, are you suggesting by that trying to generate energy within the city is going to might elicit pushback from city residents because it would be ugly or obnoxious or smokestacks or something?
Yeah, I mean, basically here in Vermont, while, I'm a strong supporter of renewable energy, we have a lot of people who basically resist due to visual blight. And I'm wondering if the city, what are the existing zoning laws and what is the city doing that's going to help to encourage renewable energy development within the city?
We've got it. Let me put it to Ashok Gupta. Do you have New Yorkers afraid of what, the Empire State Building or Chrysler Building being clad in solar panels and lost to energy technology?
I guess it's always possible. I mean, the projects we've seen so far have not gotten much opposition when you integrate solar into the buildings. You have to remember, in the city, we actually have 8,000 megawatts, like eight very, very large power plants in the city, primarily half of them in Queens.
But those aren't green, are they?
They're not.
We've seen the smokestacks. Those are old-fashioned,
exactly.
Ugly.
I think the mayor's plan is first and foremost about making buildings more efficient, secondly about cleaning up those power plants. and getting, you know, getting rid of them if we can, and then doing as much as we can, of course, with distributed generation, solar, cogeneration, and others. So far, we haven't seen opposition. Obviously, over time, if you're trying to grow something and it accelerates, there might be some opposition. But I think overall, I'm optimistic that this is going to be something we can bring people along with, because they know that if they don't do this, there's going to be pollution somewhere else and maybe very close to them in the city, or it's going to come, you know, from
outside. You can have it produced in the Midwest and then blow back as acid rain.
Exactly. So I think you can't get away from the pollution, and we'll have to do some education about the visual impact issue, if people believe it, and how that compares to the real pollution that we're dealing with.
Timothy Beatley, you've looked a lot at European cities, Copenhagen, Stockholm, Barcelona, London, and others. Are there steps on going green that elicit pushback from communities that aesthetically people just aren't ready to go for?
No, I frankly don't see that. I think that's a fear that some might have before they actually see the projects on the ground. And it's very interesting. Solar panels and solar rooftops, to me, they're beautiful, and I think most people have that similar kind of reaction. I was in Toronto on Friday, and there is a very large wind turbine right in downtown Toronto, and it's a very interesting story. Nobody's complaining. It's beautiful, and you turn a corner and see it from different angles, and it's just a lovely addition. So quite the contrary, I think. I think these things can be actually positive enhancements of cities and urban living.
There's the green is good message. Sheila's calling from Newton, Massachusetts. Hi, Sheila. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
I wanted to actually follow up about this wind turbine business. I was wondering, New York City being basically at sea level, how high up do you have to get in order to get enough air movement to make one of a wind turbine practical? And it seems to me that the rooftops of a lot of buildings would be perfect places, perhaps, to put wind turbines. I've been wondering whether or not such things might be put, for example, on the center strips in highways where we already have public land,
right,
easy access. But I wondered how high they needed to be. I know that, of course, the wind varies from place to place.
Well, let's ask. You're picturing a lot of propellers all over the place. Ashok, have you thought about it? Can you picture, you know, sort of a beanie top on New York with spinning propellers everywhere?
I mean, it's possible. It was, by the way, considered as part of the redevelopment of the Trade Center site. One of the early designs had wind integrated into the buildings in terms of more of the, not the vertical, but the horizontal approach. But I am skeptical about wind being the resource in the city. I think
because of altitude, as Sheila suggests, or think, simply just too much moving stuff around?
Yeah, I think it's just a combination of cost and how much energy you would get from windmills, and I think we need to, yeah. But again, we should look at it, consider it. But my initial stance is that
little skepticism,
it may not be
there.
Ideal, right? Certainly not in Manhattan, and certainly the outer boroughs. There might be opportunities, and certainly offshore, there may be huge opportunities.
Professor Beatley, you saw a beautiful turbine in Toronto, you say, but more broadly, is wind part of the urban green equation?
Yeah, I think it is. I think it has yet to be fully tested and explored, and it will vary depend on the city, depending on the location and wind patterns and so on. And I think the emphasis should be that there isn't one silver bullet that's going to do it for us. We have to put in place a resilient, diverse, renewable energy portfolio, and it's and wind is part of that, and it's micro turbines, I think, is part of the story in the city, and we have examples of London and other cities that are moving forward with that. But it's also, as has been said, it's offshore, larger wind turbines offshore. Copenhagen is a good example of this. They have a very, very successful 20 large turbines just offshore, off the harbor, producing a lot of power for that city. And every city will have its own, you know, special, its own unique opportunities to do those things.
And more broadly, cities don't live in a vacuum very often. There are state or federal governments in this country and others. Timothy Beatley, what's the track record here? Do cities tend to have the leeway to move ahead on ambitious programs like this? Do they get caught up in national politics? And what do you foresee for New York on that front?
Well, they do get caught up in state and federal politics, but I think I'm optimistic. I see so many good examples of cities like London and Copenhagen moving forward and doing very innovative and creative things. It does help, of course, to have supportive state and federal partners. And so, for example, I mentioned Toronto. You're seeing this amazing emergence of a grassroots solar neighborhoods, actually, neighborhoods getting together and buying solar panels. Well, that's made possible in large part because of a marvelous provincial law in Ontario that actually requires the 90 utilities in that province to buy power from those small producers at a premium price. It's called the standard offer contract, and that's helped to reduce the cost and make it much more financially feasible for these PVs to be installed. Mm-hmm. So I think it has to be a partnership and a combination of efforts at different levels.
Ashok Gupta, we've only got a few seconds here. Already some pushback on the idea of taxing cars coming into the city, the $8 a day. Do you expect Albany to ultimately be an ally in this, or Washington for that matter?
Yeah, I think most parts of the plan will be strongly supported. The governor is very interested in the energy efficiency pieces for both buildings and power plants. And I think when people start focusing on transit funding and the need to give people more options, there'll be even greater support in Albany for that as well.
Well, it is fascinating news. We'll be watching closely to see how it unfolds in New York and in other cities around the country. Timothy Beatley in Charlottesville, Virginia, at the University of Virginia School of Architecture, author of Green Urbanism, Professor Beatley, thanks a lot for being here.
Thanks, Tom.
And Ashok Gupta on Mayor Michael Bloomberg's Sustainability Advisory Board, right in the middle of this whole thing. Wonderful to have you with us today. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.